This morning, 61 Kenosha, 64 Racine, 56 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduates and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and it is a happy day on the morning show because we are welcoming back for the first time this season Kate Jerome, who is an instructor in the horticulture department here at Gateway Technical College. And for any of you who listen to the morning show with any regularity, surely know by now, Kate Jerome joins us on a fairly regular basis in the late spring and through the summer months to offer advice on lawn and garden care and to answer questions which you might have about your own lawn or garden. And so we want to welcome your questions for Kate Jerome over the next hour. And you can do so by giving us a call at 262-564-8450, 262-564-8450, or you can send me an email. And I've brought up my simplest email to access, which is actually my Carthage email. So it's gberg at carthage.edu, gberg@carthage.edu. And if it's simpler for you to offer up your question that way rather than calling, then go ahead and do it that way. But one way or another, if you have a question for Kate Jerome, she will be happy to answer it. We have several email questions that have already come in that we'll be posing to Kate at some point. So once again, the phone number here, if you would like to call Kate Jerome and pose a question to her directly, is 262-564-8450. Kate Jerome, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning.
So tell us what kind of a winter it was.
Oh, you know, it was Wisconsin. It was probably a little bit milder as far as temperature goes, although when we were in the middle of it, it certainly didn't seem that way. Snow was pretty normal this year, maybe a little less than usual. So the things we're seeing in the garden are going to be pretty much what we see every year.
So as far as you can tell, thus far, this is a relatively normal spring, garden-wise and lawn-wise?
Normal spring, except that it is a little late. That's the one thing, that winter lasted a little bit longer than we're used to. We started into spring, but then the temperature kept dropping at night. So we went into the 40s. So people that like to get their tomatoes out at the end of April or beginning of May either suffered if they did get them out, or they had to hold them in the garage.
So things are starting late. Is that in any way a problem or not a big deal?
No, it's just impatience, that's all. They'll catch up just fine.
Well, of course, when you're in the gardening business, you learn a little patience along the way. So we have a lot to talk about, a number of questions to get to, and there are also a couple of events coming up. And why don't we just make real quick mention of those right off the bat? And I should mention that a colleague of yours is actually going to be coming on for part of the program on Tuesday to talk about these a little bit further. But why don't you mention what's coming up here at Gateway over the next couple of days?
Well, one of our exciting events that comes up on June 6th on Saturday is our annual plant sale that is put on by our horticulture club. And this is our big blowout. We have lots and lots of annual flowers, perennial flowers. We are being joined by the Wild Ones this year with native plants, so we will have their sale going on simultaneously, which is really exciting to us.
And on the same site?
On the same site, right there. We're all going to be doing it together, so we're very excited about that. The sale runs from 9 to 2 on Saturday, and it is cash or check only for us. I'm not sure about the Wild Ones, whether they do accept credit cards, but we don't yet at this point. But we'll have lots of students there to help load your car, lots of fun things going on.
Cool. So that's Saturday, June 6th, the annual plant sale here and on the Kenosha campus.
On the Kenosha campus at the Horticulture Center, the Pike Creek Horticulture Center, which is on the southwest side of the campus. So you just, any one of the driveway, well, actually the northern driveways are better to come in, and then just come back toward the greenhouses, and there will be parking and lots of help.
Very good. There are two other things you wanted to mention. One of them, the farm stands here on campus every Friday.
Right. We now have our farm stand open to the public, and it's Friday from 11 to 2, every Friday through the summer from 11 to 2, and we have fresh produce. We also will be selling some plants. We have herbs. We have farm fresh eggs, organic free-range eggs. And eventually we'll have honey as well, not from our own bees, but we do have a farmer that's supplying us with local honey. So come by between 11 and 2 every Friday. And then on Saturday from 9 to 2, we are also at Harbor Market, downtown Kenosha, every Saturday. We're even there when the weather's bad. Some people sort of bail when the weather's bad, but we're even there when the weather's bad because we have a nice tent. And again, we take our farm fresh produce, which is all organically grown, and we do take plants. And we also have an educational feature at our booth every week. So you come, not only do you come and fill your market bag, but you can also learn something while you're there.
Excellent. And what you are selling are things that Gateway grows.
Right. Everything we sell is something that has been grown on our campus.
Very good. So that's the farm stands on campus. That's the Kenosha campus.
Right. Kenosha campus, Pike Creek Center on Fridays, and then Harbor Market on Saturdays.
Great. All right. We have a number of questions to get to, and we'll remind everybody of the phone number in case somebody wants to call and directly speak to you on the air. The phone number is 564-8450. The area code is 262. Again, 262-564-8450 if you would like to talk to Kate Jerome. Kate, our first question comes from Mary in Racine. Her question is, we recently cut down Quaking aspen. Okay. At the end of March, and poured a Roundup type chemical on the stump, hoping to kill the roots. They self-propagated all over the yard, including next to the house, under the air conditioner, under the deck. Thus, the reason we cut it down. Guess what? The roots are still growing. Any suggestions on how to kill them?
That's a tough one to handle. Roundup is really not strong enough. You're going to need to go with one of the more serious brush killers. And this is a good time to do it because they're in very active growth. So take you can get the brush killer just in a spray bottle, a small spray bottle. Take your pruners out, cut down the shoots that are coming up, and immediately either paint or spray that with a serious brush killer. And look on the label to make sure that the brush killer will take care of poplars, aspens, cottonwoods. Those are all in the same family. You're just going to have to keep at it. Hmm. Once you have it, they're a little bit hard to get rid of.
So Roundup isn't strong enough? Is that what you're saying?
Roundup works better on herbaceous or soft material. It doesn't work as well on woody material. So if you were trying to get rid of something that's woody, you know, some people want to get rid of their green ash, although the ash borer is taking care of that for us. But getting rid of those buckthorn, honeysuckle, all of those things that are woody shrubs, Roundup is just not strong enough for that. So you do need to go with the brush killer.
Hmm. All right, so that's the advice for Mary, that Roundup is not equal to the task. And do these brush killers, they have particular names? Or
there's many, many of them on the market. So you just need to go and look at what's on the shelf. First go for brush killer and then read the label as to exactly what it kills, because it may be chemical specific for specific shrubs. So just read very carefully and make sure you follow the directions exactly.
Right. I would assume that when we're talking about this, it's probably imperative that she's using some kind of a chemical brush killer. I mean, I know some people have concerns or reservations about that, but for something like this, you need to probably go for a weapon like that?
Well, I don't like using chemicals either, but in a case like this, the only other option is to bring a stump grinder in and cut it and grind the stump out and keep it that. I mean, which you can do, but it's a little bit more expensive, a little bit more involved.
Right.
So, you know, I wish there were another way to do it. But Mother Nature makes very tenacious plants.
That's a way to put a positive spin on it. Very good. All right. Question number two comes to us from Jessica in Kenosha. She asks, is there a particular bug that frequently attacks trumpet vines? We always have flower clusters covered with little black bugs, which prevent the flowers from opening. What can I use to ward them off? Also, the vines tend to always end up with white fungus on the leaves. Is this likely mildew or mold? Any advice for that? Maybe ahead of answering her specific questions, just say a word about, someone as ignorant as I, what trumpet vines are.
Trumpet vines are, it's a woody vine, and the stems twine and climb, so they will climb on chain link fences are on along, they'll even climb along a cedar fence, a cedar rail fence. They have beautiful, beautiful tubular shaped flowers in all shades of red and orange and yellow. So the flowers are wonderful, but they are a rampant vine and they do tend to they kind of come up where you're not expecting them to come up. So it's something that if you want a trumpet vine, make sure you know what you're getting yourself into, first of all.
So it can get out of control pretty easily.
It can get out of control, right. The little black bugs that are on the trumpet vine, I'm not positive without seeing one of them, but my guess is they are, they may be grape weevils or grape flea beetles. I'm not sure yet. The trumpet vine is related to grapes, so that's why I think that it might be something that also affects grapes. They're very hard to control, but if you go out early in the morning when it's really cool, you can actually hand pick them off pretty easily. There's not a spray that's going to really stop them. You could try a soap spray, but I've tried to stop them on grapes before, and it's hard to do without hand picking. But hand picking's very easy if you go out when it's cool and they're really sluggish. You just get a bucket and just tap them, you know, flick them into the bucket.
I was going to ask you what difference does it make that it's cool, but it's that it
they're
slows
sluggish,
them down.
Right. They don't hop, because if it is the flea beetle, they hop, and once you go for them, they jump away from you. So just get a coffee can with some soapy water in the bottom and just flick them into that. And the minute they hit the soapy water, it takes away the outer coating on, and they die. So you don't have to smash them. You can just drop them in soapy water.
And the soapy water does the rest.
Right. As for the mildew, it is a common problem on trumpet vine and lilac and all different sorts of plants. We've had really good luck using a milk spray to prevent powdery mildew. And we've used it on our squash, and we've used it on rosemary with very good success. And I'd have to look up the exact formula, but I think what we're using right now is 10 to 1, 10 parts of water to 1 part milk. And it is the milk, it's the protein in the milk that actually kills the fungus and,
wow.
and stops it. And so that's, it's, I was very surprised to hear this. So as soon as you're, you know, you can use expired milk, it doesn't matter whether it's skim or whole or... I actually like to use skim because if you use whole milk, the butterfat in it tends to get a little rancid and smell kind of funny in the garden. But skim milk doesn't have that same fat in it. So give it a try. There are fungicides available. Fungicides usually work as preventive. So before you see it, you can spray a fungicide. There is a baking soda spray that Cornell has recommended for years. It's a tablespoon of baking soda, a teaspoon of soap, a dish detergent, basically, in a gallon of water. And that you spray that on every 3 or 4 days. So it's kind of, you just have to play with it and see what works for you. If it's in the shade, it's always going to be a problem. So that's, again, sighting a plant makes a big difference. A plant that is in full sun, that can tolerate full sun, which trumpet vine can, usually doesn't have as much of a problem.
Because there's a little less moisture gathering
exactly.
there.
Yep.
Excellent. So. Would you mind restating that intriguing milk solution one more time?
Just because mm-hmm. that it's just 10 parts of water to 1 part milk. In a gallon of water, I mean, well, however much water, you know, 10 parts water to 1 part, 10 parts of water to 1 part milk. I have to stop and make sure I'm getting this right. And it's better to spray it in the evening or in the early morning so that you don't spray it when it's going to be hit with direct sun right afterwards because you can have some damage caused by the sun.
Hmm. Great idea. So for Jessica and then some and pick off those little bugs when,
bugs
it's,
off,
when
yeah.
it's in the morning, and they are not going to be quite so hard to catch. Very good. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, feel free to send me an email to gberg@carthage.edu or give us a call. That's actually the best thing to do. And the phone number here is 564-8450, 564-8450. The area code is 262. And you can talk directly to Kate Jerome right on the air. Kate, question number three comes to us from Ellen. The question is, I planted 3 lilac bushes over 4 years ago, 2 near our property line flanking a birch tree and 1 in the center of my bird and butterfly garden. They are growing just fine, but no lilacs, at least none any of the springs since I planted them. They are in a slightly shaded area, but have plenty of room to spread out. What do I need to do to have them grow lilac blossoms? She adds, I purchased 2 from the farmer's market and 1 from a local tree company, so these are local lilacs. So I suppose that's she's trying to address one question which might come up. You know, maybe these are lilacs that don't belong here, but it sounds like they do.
Right. Being local is not as much of an issue with lilac as it is with some other things. The first issue that I see is if they are in partial shade. Lilacs really need absolute full sun to bloom well. So that they will bloom sometimes in partial shade, but the other issue is they are just not quite old enough. You just have to be patient again. They will start blooming at some point, but they have to put on a certain amount of girth with the stems before you'll start getting any blossoms. So be patient. That's all I can tell you at this point is just be patient. It'll happen. It'll happen.
So how patient? I mean, how much longer does she have to wait?
It depends on how big they were when she put them in. You know, it's I purchased lilacs. I can give an example of my own. I purchased lilacs about 4 years ago, and they were in a 1-gallon bucket. So they were fairly small, maybe a foot and a half tall, and it took them 4 years before they started blooming. So, and they're blooming this year, and here from here on, they'll just keep more and more blossoms, I'm sure. I
mean, so they're blooming for the first time this year.
Yeah, yeah. So it just takes time. And if they're in shade, it's going to take a little bit longer.
Hmm. All right. So Ellen needs to be patient. There's answer number 3. For those of you just joining us on the morning show today, my guest is Kate Jerome, who is from the Horticulture Department here at Gateway Technical College. And Kate joins us from time to time in the late spring through the summer to answer questions that you might have about the lawn or garden. And if you have a question for Kate Jerome, you can send me an email like someone just did, gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G, gberg@carthage.edu. Or better yet and simpler yet, give us a phone call. The area code is 262. The phone number is 564-8450, 262-564-8450 to go on the air to talk with Kate Jerome. Kate, a question from Holly in Racine. This spring, I transplanted some garlic cloves, culinary garlic, not wild garlic, that had sprouted in my garden over the winter, transplanting it into a half-barrel planter. How do I know when the bulbs are fully mature and ready to harvest?
If you transplant it in the spring, it's going to be set back just a little bit. Normally, garlic is planted in the fall, and obviously yours was planted by nature or was left in the garden last fall, so you should be in pretty good shape. The general rule of thumb among people who do garlic, and there are a lot of really crazy garlic people out there, but you need to wait until the three-fifths, and I know that sounds crazy, but three-fifths of the leaves have turned brown. If you do it before that, when there you have more green leaves still, the garlic cloves may not separate into the bulbs, into the individual cloves that we use for cooking. And if you wait longer than that, when they're completely brown, then the bulb tends to split and the cloves all separate. Still perfectly edible, but they won't keep. They won't save over the winter. So you're aiming for that three-fifths of those leaves, and then that's time to dig them. For traditionally planted garlic, it usually is in late June to early July, but it just depends on the weather. Sometimes it's earlier, sometimes it's later. So just count those leaves.
Huh. Interesting.
People will think you're crazy, but count your leaves.
And you mean literally count the leaves.
Right. Count the leaves. And three-fifths is pretty standard. Not half of them, three-fifths.
I'm very intrigued. Very good. So you need to know your math when you're into this gardening. I want to actually skip to a more recent question just because it's mildly related to the question you just answered. Someone again from Racine. My favorite garden center has rather dramatically expanded its selection of herbs. So for the first time, I am thinking about growing some herbs in my garden. Any recommendations for what sorts of herbs are most likely to be successful in a garden that, by the way, has quite a lot of shade?
Shade is a hard thing with herbs because most of them like full sun. So you probably will have pretty good luck if you use basil. And there are many different kinds of basil out there, all different flavors of basil. Oregano will actually grow in some shade. It tends to be a little bit leggier and stretch a bit in the shade, but the flavor is still good. You can still certainly use it. I would stay away from thyme and lavender and rosemary because they all really do better in full sun. You could certainly try them and see. Who knows? You may have good luck with it. Sage is also a full sun herb. I have had reasonable luck with sage in the shade, but it doesn't tend to come back. It's a perennial herb, and it doesn't tend to come back if it's grown in the shade. It tends to die. So you treat it like an annual and replace it every year, and that works just fine.
Hmm.
But otherwise, some of the more leafy green type herbs, sorrel is sometimes considered an herb, sometimes called a green. It has a lemony flavor to the leaf. That will grow in shade, and it is a perennial as well. You can grow lovage, which has the celery-like flavor. That will grow in shade. Make sure when you put your lovage in that it's in the spot that you don't mind if it spreads a little bit because it will spread. So keep that in mind. Also, anything in the mint family, they'll grow in shade, but they will also take over your house if you're not careful. So the mints are wonderful, but generally I recommend whenever you plant any kind of mint to put it in a pot and sink the pot in the garden so that it sort of contains the roots. But it still can come out the holes of the pot. I mean, it will also grow on the driveway.
Wow.
So you have to be careful with mint.
Hmm. What is the distinction, by the way? What makes an herb?
Basically, just any sort of pungency to the leaves.
Pungency, okay.
Some people consider, like sorrel, for example. Sorrel doesn't really have the same type of leaf that the other herbs do because it's more of a green. But it's a pungent type of plant, and so many people consider it an herb as well.
In terms of the way it ends up getting used. Then.
Right. You don't use big portions. You use small portions to flavor dishes. Same with tarragon. Tarragon has a little different leaf, a little different structure than the other herbs, but it's considered an herb because you don't use very much of it. You don't eat big platefuls of tarragon.
Right.
I don't think anybody could.
That would be interesting. Well, very good. Good advice for our caller. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, feel free to send an email to gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G, gberg@carthage.edu, or give us a call, area code 262 564-8450, and we'll be happy to put you on the air directly with Kate Jerome, who will be happy to answer your questions, whatever they may be, about the garden or about your lawn. Kate, another question, actually sort of related to the one you just answered. What are the best varieties of potatoes to plant in our area?
We can grow just about any type of potato. I would steer away from the really big russets because they're a little bit harder. They have a little more disease issue than some of the other potatoes. But any of the small reds, the small Yukon Golds, do wonderfully in our area. Fingerlings, the small kind of odd-looking, odd-shaped little potatoes, do quite well. I've grown blue potatoes and pink potatoes. And It's if you go to a mail-order source, you'll have a wider variety. But generally, the garden stores and the feed stores you offer just one or two types. And, you know, give them a try. Lakota Red is one of the most common ones that you see around here. And Yukon Gold is the other one that's very common. And they're both very tasty and grow with basically no care, which is a good thing.
Right. I'm just ignorant enough that it never even dawned on me that there are really different kinds of potatoes. I mean, I knew there were three or four, but from the grocery store. But Mr. Caravati from the Lakeside Market, I mean, I think he grows something
hundreds,
like hundreds. Yeah.
Hundreds of types. The heirloom potatoes, that there's so many possibilities out there. And once you start tasting them, and you will actually, you will taste the differences between the different varieties. So it's a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
Very good. All right. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, gberg@carthage.edu, or better yet, give us a call at 262-564-8450, and Kate will be happy to answer any question that you might have, question or concern about your lawn or your garden. Kate, an email question that just came in. I have been trying to grow lavender from a seed for years, but have never been able to get any result. Nothing ever happens. It is in full sun in a pot. When should I start it, and should I start it inside or outside? Any advice for growing lavender?
Lavender is very hard to grow from seed. We don't even try that here. We order in the little plugs that are made from cuttings. So if you really want to grow lavender, your best bet is to take a cutting and try and root it. Trying to grow from seed, you have to make sure, first of all, that the seed has been stratified, that it has a cool period in the refrigerator before you plant it, and the conditions that it needs to germinate without rotting they're very tight, I guess. If you let it dry out at all, it's gone. If you get it too moist, it's gone. So I admire the the will to do this, but I think you're not going to have great success no matter what. You'll be much better off if you take a cutting from a friend's plant. Just, take a little snip, dip it in rooting powder, and then root it that way. I think you'll have a lot better luck than trying with seed.
Could you just be a little more specific about exactly how that is done? I mean, what exactly you take from the plant, or doesn't it much matter?
You just take a shoot that's maybe 2 to 3 inches long and then kind of strip off the lower leaves. And then the rooting powder you can get at any garden store. It's not very expensive. And
what does that do?
It actually it's a root stimulant. It helps the roots grow faster. Lavender takes a long time to root, and if you don't use a rooting powder, the shoot that you take very often starts to die before it produces roots. And so the rooting powder makes the roots happen faster so that it gets it takes hold before the shoot starts to die.
Very good. Good advice then on growing lavender. Kate, we're going to actually pause in all the questions. We have actually quite a number yet to deal with here, but one of the people I heard from via email ahead of your appearance has more of a thank you than a question, but I think it's something that would be good for us to talk about. She's right in the middle of some packing, or I think she would probably be calling to say thank you in person. She writes, I wanted to share that Kate encouraged me when she was your guest last to go ahead and set up a vermiculitor compost bin?
Vermiculture
compost bin. And someone who took the certification course at the time, evidently here at Gateway?
It's just a general course. It's not a certification course.
Yeah, okay. It's a permaculture certification course at the time.
Permaculture, okay.
Helped me. And Kate offered free worms on your program, and she gave some. And I am delighted to report that I have been successful with the worm bin, and I have added three more trays on top. The worms are plentiful and thriving. The compost tea has been awesome for my plants, and I just established new square foot raised beds where she's moving, and intend to integrate some of the compost and the worms. I really appreciate her encouragement, as I might not have ventured out on my own without her expertise.
Well, that's great to hear. Many people think worms, ick. I don't want worms, thank you. But I have a worm bin in my kitchen. It's inside. There is no odor. They are creating a lot of good compost and compost tea for my garden as well. And I can't encourage people enough. It's a great way to recycle your vegetable waste right in the kitchen. And the product that comes from it is just like gold in the garden. You take a handful of worm compost for each tomato, and I've seen the results. The result, you'll have a tomato that is twice as big as one that you didn't use it on. It's amazing.
Hmm. Wow. So, what was the compost tea that she was referring to?
That's the liquid, basically, that is produced. You can actually make compost tea by taking some compost and making a little tea bag and steeping it. But generally, the worm bins have some liquid runoff, and there's a catch basin for them, and you just use that liquid runoff, and it's very potent, very concentrated, and it's like gold.
Wow. Gold from earthworms. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought? Very good. All right. So a nice, hearty thank you to Kate Jerome for the help which you gave to her, and I'm sure to others who heard that program and maybe followed that very advice. If you have a question for Kate Jerome, please give us a call at 262-564-8450 or send me an email, gberg@carthage.edu. gberg@carthage.edu is the simplest email to utilize. And I will be happy to pass on your question to Kate Jerome. So, Kate, this question concerns a fenced-in side yard where our dogs run. We recently had mulch laid down in it for the very first time. We like the look very much, but quite a few weeds have sprouted up. Are those weeds likely to die off on their own, or do we need to do something to eradicate them if we don't want to live with them?
It depends on the weed. The annual weeds, if you take a hoe and just kind of chop them down a little bit, they're probably not going to just go away on their own. Annual weeds, you want to make sure that you don't let them go to seed, because then they will just make new weeds. So a hoe, just actually one of the hoes that kind of slips under the mulch, is probably your best bet for taking care of most of the weeds. If they're perennial weeds like dandelion and thistle, you're going to need to manage them, because once they pop through, they will continue to come back. So you can use an herbicide if you choose. Roundup would work on those. Most of the weeds like dandelion and thistle, if you're really diligent about it, you can use hot water. Take the hot water, a steaming kettle out, and just pour it in the center. You're going to have to treat them 3 or 4 times. You can also use vinegar, white vinegar. And they're a lot less expensive than going to a chemical, and actually, of course, much better for the environment.
Hmm. Great. Another question. Let's see. This is from Kenosha. I want to know, what is the most effective and safe way to get rid of thistles in my vegetable garden? Thistles in the vegetable garden.
It's one of my perennial problems.
So, been there, done that.
Yep. Thistles actually run under the ground. So if you think you've gotten the thistle, it'll have a little brother that's hanging out over there that maybe hasn't popped up yet. So, again, you have to be absolutely diligent. I just pull mine. I have a soil knife, or also one of the old-fashioned dandelion diggers. Just go and stick it in the ground and pop it up. You'll get a good portion of the root, and if you keep at it, eventually it exhausts the plant and it goes away. But it's in the vegetable garden, you certainly don't want to use any herbicides if you can avoid it. And again, as I said, hot water or vinegar sometimes works. But if you don't mind weeding, just think of it as meditation. It's your meditation time in the day. Go out there with your dandelion weeder and just go after them. It's the best thing to do.
Good exercise.
Good exercise. Good being out in the garden.
Very good. Nick from Kenosha is asking about varieties of peppers. What kind of peppers are likely to do especially well around here? And if you have particular varieties of which you're especially fond?
Peppers do very well, either chilies or sweet peppers. And it's a matter of taste, a matter of what the garden centers are offering right now. Big Bertha is probably my favorite of the red bells. It's a very big, sweet red bell pepper, but it has to be supported because the peppers literally are sometimes a pound a piece. They're huge. So you need to put a tomato cage or something around it to support it. There are a lot of other sweet peppers. Of course, the sweet banana is always a favorite. And as far as chilies, it's up to you as to what you like the taste of. The milder Anaheims and Serranos I love. I'm also a fan of Thai chilies, which are really hot. So it's just a matter of the way that I like to do it is I like to go to the garden store and write down the varieties they have, go home, look them up, and then figure out exactly what sounds best for me, and then go back and purchase. It's an extra step, but that way you know exactly what you're getting, and you can suit your own taste. They all do very well in our climate, absolutely wonderfully in our summers.
So this is good pepper country.
Very good pepper country. Very good.
Another question just came in via email. Kate, we had new shrubs put into our front yard landscaping, replacing some older bushes that had grown unsightly. I can't read my own handwriting. What should we be doing to keep them doing well? Generally speaking, do small bushes need a lot of loving attention?
They don't need a lot of attention except water. Especially if they're new this year, you need to make sure that they get that proverbial inch of water a week. They do not need to be fertilized. In fact, shrubs of most types need to be fertilized maybe once every 4 or 5 years. We have a tendency to over-fertilize, so don't fertilize them. Just make sure that they get enough water, that they're kept stress-free. So in other words, they don't go into drought mode. So the water is the issue. I also highly recommend mulching beneath them, making sure that they're in a bed that is mulched because that'll help maintain the moisture. It'll keep the weed competition down. But otherwise, just enjoy them. They don't need a lot of babying.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I am pleased to have with me in the studios today for the morning show, Kate Jerome, who is a horticulture instructor here at Gateway Technical College. And she is answering questions and concerns about the lawn and garden. And if you have a question or concern for her, please give us a call at 262-564-8450, and we'll put you on the air to speak directly with Kate. Or you can send me an email, gberg@carthage.edu, G-B-E-R-G, gberg@carthage.edu, and we can pass the question on to Kate that way, and she will be happy to answer your question as best she can. Kate, I want to just pause in the questions to share something else with you. This is a little along the lines of the earlier thank you note. This correspondent says, in addition to the urban farm at Gateway, Kate, I believe, are you the current president of the Friends of Hawthorne Hollow?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And our mentor for the new market garden and food forest at Hawthorne Hollow. This is from Dan Lyons. The students there actually helped us start many of our seeds this year. We're starting a Kickstarter campaign on Monday. The whole project was inspired by something Kate said to me once about market gardening and that you could really do a lot on 2 acres if you knew what you were doing. So we got ourselves informed and went to town. And he said, I don't know if you'll have time to mention the project on the air, but he passed along a flyer that they're distributing around town. He says, we've already got half an acre planted, and we'll have another half acre planted by the end of the week. So it sounds like an exciting project. Again, the Hawthorne Hollow Organic Market Garden and Food Forest. Tell us more about this.
It's a very exciting project, and one that my students are going to be involved in hopefully through the summer. We'll be doing that as a service learning project to get out there and help them do this. But it's Dan is one of those people that has more energy than I can possibly imagine. So every time I see him, he says, okay, what can we do? How are we going to do this? There's energy, there's enthusiasm. It's going to be a wonderful project, and they will have a farm stand where it's at the corner of Green Bay Road and Highway A, and that's where their farm is, and that's where the farm stand will be. And Hawthorne Hollow is doing, they have bees, and they're going to do chickens, and I mean they're doing the whole thing. But the exciting part about this is not just the vegetable, the farm market part of it, but this food forest, this idea that they're...
I've never heard that term.
Well, it's a term that's comes from permaculture, so it is basically doing what nature does. So when you have a food forest, you mimic the forest. So in the forest has the upper canopy and the middle canopy and then an herbaceous layer, but you do this in food. So your upper canopy may be fruit trees, the lower may be fruit shrubs like raspberries and gooseberries, and then the lower level is some kind of an herb ground cover that you can harvest from. So it's very sustainable, it's very comfortable. It's the way, if we weren't trying to absolutely manage every aspect of our lives, it's the way that we would be living. So it's a very nice step back into a method that works in nature, but is completely sustainable.
Wow.
So it's definitely something to go. They'll also be bringing school groups through, and so it'll be their demonstration garden, so everybody can see what a food forest is.
Hmm. One of the things he said that intrigued me was something about how you can make a lot happen on, did he say, 2 acres if you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what are the kind of mistakes that somebody is apt to make if you don't know what you're doing?
Well, with the Urban Farm at Gateway, that's what we teach, is how to do this intensive gardening on a very small area.
Hmm.
You have to make sure your soil, the whole key to it is soil preparation, making sure your soil is alive and well-prepared and cared for, so that it continues to produce these good vegetables. We've all seen how big agriculture, that in years past, it's changing, but in years past, they go in and they plant this crop, they harvest it, and the soil is devoid of anything. And so then they have to pour on the chemical fertilizers, because that's the only thing that will make the plants grow. But with the whole idea of sustainable farming and gardening, you manage your soil, and your soil takes care of you, basically. Your soil then will produce amazing amount of vegetables and fruits, and it's just a different way of looking at things. Everything is planted a little bit more intensely in a small garden like this, but because you have the soil preparation done, things grow very well. They don't compete with each other. So it's a different way of looking at farming and gardening, and they're doing it on 2 acres is actually quite large for an urban farm.
Hmm.
We teach about doing it on 1/2 acre. You can do it in your backyard.
Wow.
You can make a living doing it. That's the other aspect of this.
Incredible. We used to live right next to Hawthorne Hollow, so I have a very soft spot in my heart for Hawthorne Hollow and how beautiful it is there.
Yeah,
so
it is really coming along well.
That's neat.
They're doing nice things there.
Glad to hear that. So people should watch for the flyers, which they are distributing with this Kickstarter campaign to help support what they're doing. Terrific. Kate, one more question's come in via email about edible flowers, of all things. The correspondent writes, my husband is a superb chef, and I've been thinking that edible flowers might be an exciting enhancement to what he does. Does Kate happen to know anything about edible flowers and what some interesting options might be for edible flowers for us to grow?
That's one of my favorite things to talk about. I love edible flowers.
Oh, I don't know that we've ever talked about this.
Huh. We incorporate them in the farm here at Gateway. I also have them growing at home. You can eat many of the flowers that we just generally use as annuals to make our gardens look better. But then you can also grow some that are specialty flowers. The one thing I will caution you on is to get onto a good website, a reliable website, usually one that has .edu after it, not .com, because that way you're going to an educational institution, to make sure that you know absolutely that the flower you are going to eat is an edible flower, because there are a lot of them out there that are not and can make you sick, actually make you sick. So it's very important that you know what you're growing and that you pay attention. And don't send someone out in the garden to pick a flower, because if you go out and pick a petunia and eat it, it's going to make you sick.
Wow.
So you don't want to do that. So some of the edible flowers that are wonderful, of course, pansies right now, pansies and Johnny Jump Ups, violas, violets, all in that same family. They're all blooming right now, so they make just pick them and toss the petals into a salad. Just absolutely gorgeous. You can eat carnations and pinks. You can eat rose petals. You can eat tulip petals. marigolds, which don't taste very good, but they sure are pretty. Any of the plants, any of the herb flowers, those are all quite edible. They may, like basil flowers, have a very mild basil flavor to them. Most of the time with edible flowers, we're not growing them for the taste. We're growing them for what they look like, and they're definitely an enhancement. Chive blossoms are wonderful tossed into salad, and they give you a slight onion flavor, but pull the flower apart and just use the individual little florets, because if you eat a whole chive flower, it's way too strong. Let me think of what other edible flowers. Nasturtiums, one of my favorites. I grow them with my cucumbers as a companion to help with cucumber beetles, to help ward off the cucumber beetles. But then you pop one up and toss it in a salad, and it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
Interesting.
It's actually a very big market area right now, because a lot of the gourmet restaurants, especially in Chicago, will purchase edible flowers that they know have been grown organically. So it's a market.
Wow. So not a bad thing for somebody to grow then.
Right.
Excellent. Well, good. I'm glad that question got posed. Kate, in our last couple of minutes, I know there are various things that people should be thinking about, including, of course, perennial weeds, dandelions and all that kind of thing. It's time to be pruning blooming shrubs. We should be thinking about our bulbs. What about our bulbs?
Bulbs are in full bloom right now, most of them. The daffodils are pretty much done. But this is the time of year when they start looking kind of ragged. So go in and cut out the flower stalks only, and try and be patient and leave the foliage until it starts to turn off color. And as soon as it starts to turn slightly yellow, then you can remove the foliage. Cut it. Don't pull it, because you may pull the bulb up. Tulips will yellow pretty quickly, so you can go in and cut those off. Daffodils seem to stay on forever and ever. So hold out as long as you can. And then in my example, I cut some daffodil foliage this last weekend, which was too early, but it starts to choke out some of my other perennials. It starts to lay down on them. So in that case, I'm okay losing a few daffodil blossoms next year, so that it doesn't, kill my peonies this year. But otherwise, this is also the time right after blooming, if you feel like you need to fertilize your bulbs, you can do it now. And also, this is the time that you can dig them and divide them. Dig them, because if you try and wait until the foliage is gone, you won't be able to find them. So dig them and move them. If they are not blooming very well, divide them, separate them out.
You mentioned on your list here of things to be doing and thinking about, you also mentioned pinching regarding mums and asters.
Right. If you're growing mums and asters, many people like to pinch them back to keep them stocky and also to produce larger blooms. Generally, the way that I like to think about it is I pinch May 1st, June 1st, July 1st, and then you stop. If you haven't pinched, it's still okay to do that. Go back and pinch, 3 or 4 inches of that each stem. Go back to a joint where there are two leaves and just pinch it out. And at that joint, it will send out two stems, and they'll keep it stocky and shorter. Asters in particular have a tendency to get really tall and floppy. So if you keep pinching them, both of these are fall bloomers, so you're not destroying any flowers at this point. Spring bloomers, you'll wreck the flowers. You can't pinch them.
You mentioned that, and of course it's hard to imagine a day after we had more than one downpour, but very likely we will have drier conditions coming, which means we need to think about our mulch.
Right. The soil is warm now, so if you haven't mulched or replenished the mulch in your shrub beds, in your perennial garden, this is the time to do it. Because even though we have had plenty of moisture, and there are some summers where we do continue to have rains, but there are also those summers we never know when it's going to stop. And the mulch keeps the soil moist. It also keeps the temperature regulated, so you don't get, if you're on bare soil, it gets really hot, and that's a stress for plants. So it keeps the temperature regulated, stops erosion, and will keep some of the weeds down.
And finally, this is the time to be out there planting squash and beans.
Yep, it's time. It's finally time. It's warm enough to start planting the warm season. Squash, beans, corn, all of those things can go in now.
Excellent. Well, we ended up answering a blizzard of questions and some really interesting ones today. So, Kate Jerome, it's always great to have you here, and I'm so grateful for your time and look forward to having you back.
It's great to be here.
And a colleague of yours, Courtney Grieve, is going to be with me for part of the program on Tuesday to talk a little further about Gateway's plant sale, which we mentioned briefly coming up on the 6th of June, and we want to remind people of the Farm Stand here on campus every Friday, 11 to 2. And Gateway is always at Harbor Market on Saturdays, 9 to 2, Kate said, even when the weather's not so good.
Right,
so.
Right.
Kate, thank you again for being here.
You're welcome.
The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Tomorrow you'll hear the interview which I recorded downtown at the Kenosha Theater. For those of you who aren't aware of it, the Kenosha Theater is a spectacular old movie house which closed back in the early 1960s, but it is an amazing space. And you'll hear my conversation recorded in the heart of the Kenosha Theater on tomorrow's program. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture